Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So it's come down to this. Ask lawmakers on either side of the aisle in Washington if the most powerful government on the planet is about to crash headlong into the budget wall and run out of spending money by the end of the day tomorrow. At this point, their answer is likely to be, I sure hope not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a program in which rates are determined by the driving habits of policyholders. Learn more at progressive.com. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us this Thursday, April 7th, a day ahead of what looks to be an increasingly likely government shutdown. Still no budget agreement. Negotiations continue. House Republicans did approve a one-week budget extension, but the White House and Senate Democrats aren't playing ball. They say that interim budget includes spending cuts and other things they just can't accept. So government agencies are preparing to turn out the lights at midnight Friday. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has been looking into the economic consequences.
Starting Saturday, up to 900,000 government employees wouldn't get paid. And that goes for the same number of government contractors. After the latest failed negotiations at the White House today, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid warned of the detrimental consequences of closing the government.
Including, as we've learned from an economic report this morning, just a shutdown of no matter how long it is, will be 0.02% drop in our domestic product.
That report from Goldman Sachs concludes that a shutdown would siphon $8 billion a week from the economy. Most of that would be made up later when funding and paychecks flow again, but not so for one vital industry in Washington.
Tourism is vulnerable.
Stephen Fuller directs the Center for Regional Analysis. He says restaurants, hotels, and vendors would suffer from the lack of customers usually here for spring break.
We would see the impacts, and individual businesses would feel them and probably not be able to recover those losses by increasing business next month.
And given how delicate the overall recovery is, Moody's economist Mark Zandi worries about the psychological effects of a long shutdown.
A lot does depend on how this affects confidence. The collective psyche is very fragile, and if we start to lose faith again, then you can construct some pretty dark scenarios.
For example, what if Congress doesn't authorize back pay for government workers this time around? In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So to recap, the Republican-led House has easily passed a stopgap funding bill, but the White House calls that a distraction and is vowing to veto the measure. Uncle Sam's spending account runs dry as of midnight tomorrow, and there's no agreement in sight. Among those lawmakers digging in is Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, a member of the House Budget Committee. He's on the line with us from the Capitol. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's cut to the chase. Is there going to be a government shutdown?
I hope not. Nobody wants to see the government shut down. We just walked off the floor having passed a continuing resolution for another week, but most importantly, funding the military through the rest of the fiscal year, make sure our troops get paid.
Now, you say you passed a continuing resolution. What is that going to do?
It basically cuts $12 billion for the fiscal year. But like I said, most importantly, it funds the military for the next 6 months.
Why is it so tough to reach bipartisan agreement on deficit cuts and tax reform?
I don't know. Each side will kind of point at each other. But we think we're asking for a very modest cut, given the size and scope of the fact that we're upside down financially and have a deficit this year of something in the magnitude of $1.5 trillion. And here we are trying to ask for a few tens of billions of dollars We think it's a reasonable balance, but good people will differ.
Well, I've heard Democrats, and not just Democrats, who are painting the GOP as unwilling to compromise on the $33 billion. And in fact, I've read some reports that some Republicans are worried that the party is in a bind here. Why not just compromise on the $33 billion and move on to bigger stuff later? Why do you think it's important to hold out for more?
Well, I think that the Republicans, having passed the continuing resolution very convincingly, not only were seeking upwards of $60 billion in cuts, but also defunded Obamacare, which is really a trillion-dollar type of event, in addition to Planned Parenthood. And so if they want to take those so-called riders off the table and then just think they can cut the 61 in half, that certainly doesn't seem like meeting us in middle ground. So, no, as the president rightly said yesterday, no one person gets everything that they want. We understand that. But we're going to have to figure out how to deal with the debt crisis and not keep punting this down the road.
You know, we're finally talking seriously about bigger entitlement cuts. Why not tax hikes? Doesn't that also need to be on the table if we're really going to dig ourselves out of this hole?
Well, if Democrats want to argue for tax hikes, they can. We happen to think that we're taxing borrowing and spending too much money already, that 25 cents out of every dollar being spent in this economy, 25% of GDP, is just far too much. You know, I hear a lot about taxing the so-called rich. That would never, ever make the type of dent that's needed in order to actually solve the long-term challenges.
I've heard people say, including people like Warren Buffett, that they're willing to pay more in taxes.
Hey,
they
can go ahead and pony up. There's nothing that precludes them from paying more right now. They don't need legislation. If Warren Buffett thinks he owes more money to the federal government, then pay it.
So let me come at this from another direction. What do you think is absolutely going to have to happen to head off a shutdown?
Well, I think the most encouraging thing is the fact that the president is actually staying in town. Yesterday, he left town. That they're going to actually sit down and spend some time talking this out.
I have to ask you, you famously have chosen to sleep in your office when in town.
Yeah.
Now, a government shutdown might mean the building shower facilities are going to be shut off. What are you going to do if that happens?
I better figure out where the local YMCA is. I bet there's one fairly close. I do have a bicycle here, so I might be visiting that YMCA.
Congressman Jason Chaffetz is a Republican from Utah. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Blame the shutdown uncertainty, a powerful aftershock in Japan, or other troubles that Wall Street would rather not have to worry about. Stocks finally gave into the pressure. Details when we do the numbers. Knuckle down or knuckle under? That tough choice still confronts a list of European countries struggling to keep up with payments on their public debt and pensions. Portugal has finally asked for a bailout from the European Union. Still, in spite of the fragile situation there and elsewhere, today the European Central Bank made it more expensive to borrow. For the first time since the global financial crisis, it raised interest rates in order to curb inflation. Contrast that with our own Federal Reserve. It's refused to raise interest rates and doesn't see inflation as a major risk. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains why Europe and the U.S. are taking different paths.
We all know that people come with some emotional baggage. So do major economies. Europe still carries the scars of runaway prices before World War I.
The Germans remember what happened when Germans went to buy bread with baskets of money. They are never going to allow that to happen again. It is very much embedded in their psyche.
That's Quincy Crosby, a market strategist for Prudential Financial. She says inflation is public enemy number one in Europe. Right now, it's at 2.6%, too high for the European Central Bank. That's why it raised interest rates today, to cool down economic growth enough to keep prices low. The Federal Reserve has a different kind of baggage, 13.5 million unemployed Americans. The Fed has two jobs. It not only has to keep inflation down, it also has to control unemployment. Zane Brown is a fixed income strategist with Lord Abbott.
One of the concerns that the Federal Reserve has is if they raise rates, it makes it even more difficult for us to create jobs.
That's because higher interest rates make it harder for companies to borrow. The Fed wants companies to borrow so they can expand and start hiring.
Banks aren't lending very much money. We all know the Fed has created a lot of money, but it's just sitting there in a big blob.
Brown says that the Fed would like to see the workforce grow by 300,000 new jobs a month before it shifts its priorities. Even though U.S. officials are openly divided on inflation, Brown doesn't expect the Fed to even think about raising interest rates until 2012. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
If you've been shopping around for signs of an economic recovery, you're probably going to find something else, vacancy signs at your local mall. A new report out today shows that in the first quarter of this year, vacancy rates at shopping centers hit an 11-year high. This mall malaise came as a bit of a surprise to analysts, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The evidence had been pointing to a recovery at the shopping mall. Retail sales seemed to be picking up, and more businesses were signing leases.
It was a bit of a surprise because vacancies were trending downwards in the latter half of 2010.
That's Victor Kalinog with the commercial real estate firm Reis. Its new research shows vacancies are up at U.S. malls. Why are malls hurting so much? Obviously, the recession plays a part. Also, developers overbuilt during the construction boom. And Kalinog says some major players are reconsidering their need for lots of space.
Even if, for example, Best Buy might be doing well, it really looks like they're reassessing their need for, say, 20 to 30,000 square foot stores. They're looking at anywhere from 1,500 square feet or less.
Of course, the internet is also to blame, siphoning off some brick and mortar shoppers. But some kinds of stores are less vulnerable to internet poachers.
People still need to feel, touch, try on apparel.
Malachi Kavanaugh is spokesman for the International Council of Shopping Centers. He says property owners are reaching out to retailers abroad
to try to bring into the States some fashion retailers from Europe. They're also looking into Asia.
He says some malls are offering free rent for new retailers. Victor Kalinog with Reis says mall owners are also experimenting with non-traditional tenants.
For example, we've seen churches, we've seen schools, we've seen medical facilities actually offer, say, standard MRIs or so on and so forth in shopping centers.
That may be innovative, but Kalinog wonders about the long-term viability of these unconventional tenants. Otherwise, he expects malls will lose more retailers before things turn around next year. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, a commentator explains why Arab nations definitely don't need a Marshall Plan.
We must remember that the Arab world is not the third world, even in this period of upheaval and uncertainty.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another big aftershock rattled Japan and the markets today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 0.1%, or 17 points, to end at 12,409. The Nasdaq receded 0.1%, or 3 points, to finish at 2796. The S&P 500 rolled back 0.1%, or 2 points. It finished at 1333. Despite all those mall vacancies, consumers pulled out their wallets last month in some stores. Costco climbed nearly 4% after reporting better-than-expected sales. Limited Brands, parent of Victoria's Secret, added more than 1.5% after beating analysts' estimates. But Target missed the mark by more than 2.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.54%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained agents committed to small business success, on the web at farmers.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at Marketplace.org.
from the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for February. Former Secretary General of the United Nations Kofi Annan turns 73. And it's a serious event with a lot of dough at stake. The National Pie Championships roll out in Orlando, Florida. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ristall. House Republicans have taken first steps to reduce the roles of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the residential mortgage market. They've also moved to cut the pay of the top executives who run those government-created businesses. This is one of those hot potato issues on Capitol Hill. Some politicians say Fannie and Freddie have served those who couldn't otherwise afford a home. Others say they've grown too large. But little has been done to undo them. Lawrence White teaches economics at New York University. He's written a book with three of his colleagues called Guaranteed to Fail, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Debacle of Mortgage Finance. I spoke to him about the reluctance to tackle Fannie and Freddie as Congress works on financial reform.
Dodd-Frank said nary a word about Fannie and Freddie. It only said the administration must come up with a report, which the Obama administration finally did. It laid out three alternatives, but I would guess we won't see anything really happen until the spring of 2013, when either the Obama administration will have been reelected or there will be a new administration which will feel that it has a mandate.
Well, what action would you suggest? The book posits some ideas, right?
Despite the fact that I don't think we're going to get any action, there is a fair amount of consensus that Fannie and Freddie should be phased out.
Necessary to replace them with something else? What would that be?
Well, there's some consensus, which is if we're going to be subsidizing housing and housing finance, it ought to be with a more focused, on-budget, targeted, smaller program that focuses on low and moderate income households. For the rest of the mortgage market, our vision is really that the private sector, a combination of banks, private securitizers, really can handle these markets and do a good job figuring out who's a creditworthy borrower, who is not, being able to decide, are these mortgages suitable for depository institutions like banks or savings institutions to hold in their portfolios? That's all something that private markets really can handle.
Well, Democrats and Republicans both say this is an important part of the American dream. Fannie Mae's slogan for a time was, we're building the American dream. Is it necessary to have any government involvement at all? Maybe just take them fully out of the equation.
I think there is a good story for government involvement to encourage people who would not otherwise become homeowners as a way of strengthening communities. Where that idea has gone wrong is extending that help to basically everybody, middle class, upper class. So people who would otherwise buy anyway are just being encouraged through the subsidies to buy larger homes on bigger lots. Where's the social benefit in that?
So if you and your colleagues have concluded that these agencies just aren't necessary, does that mean that the consumer would not lose out if we wind them down?
It's clear mortgage rates would be a little bit higher. A quarter of a percentage point higher than they otherwise would be. Grass is not going to grow in the streets of America over a quarter of a percentage point differential. It would be only a modest effect, but we would have a more robust mortgage system where the private sector is there doing what it does best. We could get innovation that way, and we wouldn't have the government having to absorb the large losses at the moment. $150 billion so far lost, and at least $200 in aggregate, possibly as much as $400 billion.
Lawrence White is a professor of economics at New York University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Today, NATO and the Libyan government traded accusations over an attack on the largest oil field in the country. This marked the first time a pumping facility was hit. Rebels also reported today they exported their first cargo of oil into the international market. The conflict over the control of Libya and its oil wealth dominates the headlines now, but years ago, Libya played an influential role in the development of the current oil market. And strange as it may sound, the story's protagonist is one Muammar Gaddafi. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has our report.
Here he was last year declaring jihad against Switzerland. For years, Gaddafi's been an embarrassment to much of the Arab world, but he was a hero once, an oil pioneer, the first Arab leader to stand up to the oil companies and win a better deal for his country. Fadil Chalabi is a former deputy head of the oil producers' cartel, OPEC.
All what happened in OPEC took place thanks to what Gaddafi did. Gaddafi started the whole process of change.
The Libyan leader came to power by military coup in 1969, and he resolved to end the old colonial relationship between the oil companies and Libya. Gaddafi demanded a higher price for Libyan oil and a majority share of the revenues. David Butter is with the Economist Intelligence Unit.
In Libya, a lot of the big oil fields were run by smaller companies, which were a bit easier to bully, if you like, from the Libyan point of view.
Occidental, then a smaller American oil company, succumbed to Gaddafi's pressure. It gave him a higher price and a bigger share of the revenues. In return, he gave Occidental greater access to Libyan oil. Samuel Chizuk of IHS Global Insight says this galvanized the rest of OPEC.
It just demonstrated that it was possible, I suppose, that he could actually go in and play these companies against each other.
The rest of OPEC followed suit, and the stranglehold of the oil majors was broken. The world woke up to the full reality of OPEC's newfound power a few years later, in October 1973.
Good evening. The Middle East war produced developments all over the world today. The oil-producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon.
The Arab oil embargo, designed initially to punish the U.S. for its support of Israel, led to the quadrupling of oil prices. Since then, money has gushed into the oil producers' coffers. But, says David Butter, not, in the case of Libya, to the benefit of the people.
The country is very underdeveloped. There's a clear lack of housing. There's none of the kind of commercial development that you see in the Gulf, which have had similar advantages to Libya.
Gaddafi is alleged to have ripped off billions in oil revenues for his own personal enrichment, and many say he's undoubtedly ploughed millions into financing terrorism abroad.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock and this is the BBC's Breakfast Time programme. It's now more than 12 hours since Britain's worst air disaster, a disaster in which a Pan Am jumbo jet crashed onto a town in Scotland.
Libya accepted responsibility for the Lockerbie bombing, which killed 270 people. Fadil Chalabi says oil played a crucial part in Gaddafi's story. He says the Libyan leader was empowered, corrupted, and even unhinged by the boundless revenues he helped unleash.
It is the oil money, the petrodollars, that's made Gaddafi, the man who was liberating his oil industry, into the image of a killer. It's the oil money.
Gaddafi says this former OPEC chief is the curse of oil personified. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We must remember that the Arab world is not the third world, even in this period of upheaval and uncertainty.
Commentator Parag Khanna.
Some oil-rich Arab nations are among the wealthiest societies on earth. Together, Arab nations possess all the capital, financial and human, necessary to rebuild themselves. They may need American assistance, but they don't need an American Marshall Plan. No greater step could be taken to alleviate the Arabs' economic and political woes than investment in cross-border infrastructure. Imagine a new pan-Arab rail network. It could connect Tripoli to Cairo to Amman to Baghdad and Damascus to Dubai. This would allow Arabs to more easily work and earn money in each other's countries and send remittances back home. More pipelines and canals could connect oil-rich and low-population states with heavily populated but poor ones. The richness of the Arab world would be more evenly distributed. Railways, pipelines, and water channels are the necessary and natural consequence of the opening of Arab societies to globalization. The young Arab generation taking to the streets from Tunisia to Tahrir Square desperately needs these new opportunities for jobs, connections, and cross-border businesses. That is why the recently launched New Palestine Party has made the ARC transport corridor linking the West Bank and Gaza its main campaign platform. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates could easily underwrite the trans-Arab transport corridors necessary to stimulate broad economic development. They have already pledged more than $1 trillion towards their own infrastructure projects leading up to Qatar's hosting of the World Cup in 2022. The new pan-Arab future isn't about fiercely nationalistic anti-colonial regimes. Instead, think of Arabs' geopolitical future as an archipelago of cities from North Africa's Mediterranean coast, curving north to Beirut and east across the Saudi Arabian peninsula to Oman. The Egyptian scholar Halim Barakat has argued that the Arab world should be viewed as a single overarching society rather than a collection of several independent nation-states. Not for centuries has that possibility been as true as today.
Parag Khanna is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. Got a comment? Write to us at marketplace.org. You can just click on the contact link.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at massmutual.com. By Chevrolet, undertaking a carbon-reducing effort, investing in projects like wind farms and planting trees across America over the next few years. On the web at chevy.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, this story sure has been resonating with a lot of tech writers today. Word that the old Commodore 64 computer is getting a makeover.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? 'Cause the Commodore's keeping up with you.
Maybe you're too young to remember how popular the Commodore 64 was back in the day, but consider how a New York Times writer started his story. I was just 6 years old when the Commodore 64 computer went on sale. And one blogger wrote how he wanted a Commodore 64 so bad that he could hardly stand it way back in the 80s when he was a little geek. Well, here's your chance. The company that bought the old brand name says it's being flooded with online orders for an updated computer that looks, on the outside, like the old Commodore 64 so many still adore. No old 5 1/4-inch floppy, but you can get a Blu-ray drive. And that 64 used to stand for a whopping 64 kilobytes of memory. The new version will have at least 2 gigabytes. As you heard a moment ago, I even found some old retro commercials they can use with hardly any changes at all.
The Commodore 64. The more things change, the more things stay the same. Commodore. In more homes than any other home computer.
Well, I doubt that'll happen again anytime soon, but who knows? And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 17 points. That's 0.1%. The Nasdaq receded 3 points, or 0.1%. The S&P 500 rolled back 2 points, 0.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, a recap of the week's business news in our weekly wrap. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that and a whole lot more tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.